Hello and welcome to the Tomorrow Brands podcast, where we explore what it takes to build a brand of tomorrow. I'm your host, Ruth Fittock, and today I'm speaking with Emmy Faust, Exited founder, angel investor, and the force behind Female Founders Rise. We get into the realities of building something from scratch, from not having a runway to what makes community actually work and how being a mum has made her a better entrepreneur. Hope you enjoy.
Hi, Emmy. Thanks so much for joining us today. Before we get into it, can you tell us a little bit more about you and your background and how you got to where you are now?
Yes, quite a long story. I'm going to give you a whistle-stop tour. I am a mum of four. I am a serial exited entrepreneur. So I've had successful and failed businesses, quite a few of both, learned a huge amount along the way. I am a micro angel investor, so that means I invest my own money in early stage businesses. The majority of my portfolio is investing in women-led businesses, and I've done, about 30 of those. And I also run a community for female founders, 10,000 female founders in the UK, called Female Founders Rise. And what I was thinking about over the weekend, actually, which is a first, I haven't actually told anyone about this, but I'm going to tell you, Ruth, because you're one of my great friends. I decided that I think what drives me and I'm passionate about is making entrepreneurship more accessible. Of course, a lot of that is helping women in entrepreneurship, and that's why I'm doing a huge amount in that space. But it's not just helping women, it's helping all underrepresented people, but also just making it more accessible so that people can understand what it involves. I've been thinking that entrepreneurship for many just seems like an unobtainable thing, and probably historically has been really hard to get into because if you don't know, you don't know, kind of thing. And one of the things I was thinking over the weekend is just like, how can I make it a process or something that is easier to understand?
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because you're right, it's obviously not taught in schools. It's not presented as a career path in the same way that jobs are. You've got 10,000 women in your community. What is their pathway to that, do you think? The most common pathway?
So I would say, of course, if you've got an entrepreneur in the family, you're going to understand it. It's going to be a much easier thing to go into. If you're connected to entrepreneurs and you, whatever, it's probably easier to go into. I think what's happened with a lot of the women in our community, and this is quite well known in female entrepreneurship, is they've spotted a problem in the world that doesn't yet have a solution, or doesn't have a solution that they think is suitable, and they set up a business for that reason because they see a need. I think other situations could be, there's a lot of people who obviously have been in corporates and then they have children or they have families and they decide that they no longer want to work in corporates and they want to work for themselves and they want to have more freedom. And then they take themselves and often set up a small business as a solopreneur, maybe initially, and then maybe that grows in the area of expertise. So yeah, I think it's just one of those things like you don't know what you don't know. And actually, if you haven't got a burning desire to be an entrepreneur, it, like you said, it's not actually taught as something that is possible. Obviously, it's not for everyone. It comes with lots of challenges. It comes with lots of highs and lots of lows and lots of responsibilities, but it can also be amazing. It also can give you financial freedom. It also can give you freedom as a person to do things. So I just think we need to explain more about what it is and how you get into it and how there are ways that you could test it out on the side to even see if it's something that might be something which you want to explore.
Yeah, I think there's also, in order to make it accessible, you have to be able to de-risk it in a way, don't you? Because I think there's a problem where a lot of founders are from a certain background.
You've
got to have the money, basically. And that then means you don't get much diversity of thought and business ownership, which just because you need, and I speak to people who are thinking about going freelance or fractional, that's what I first thing I say to them is you just need a runway because it takes time. It takes time to build something. And not everybody has that freedom or luxury, do they, to create something.
Exactly. I think that's the thing. Like I said, if you grow up in a family of entrepreneurs, you might have a buffer. If you're coming from like a wealthy family, you might have a buffer where you can explore these ideas and you're still got somewhere to live and you're getting paid. I think one of the things that I'm really keen to talk more about in the future, not just today, but just generally, is the things that you can do to explore entrepreneurship that you can just be doing on the side to A, understand if there's a need and a want and if people will pay for it, and B, to explore if it's actually something that you want to do. And I think there are definitely ways that you can do that. And that's what I've done with Female Founders Rise. Obviously, I was in a privileged position because I had money to do that on the side. But actually, I'd been really poorly and I was recovering. So this was never a full-time thing. This was very much like a little passion project at the beginning until I saw that it could become a business. And I do think that there's things that we can all do on the side whilst we're doing other things to explore if entrepreneurship is for us and if what we think we want to do, if there is actually a viable need for it, with before we jump in and quit our full-time roles or quit our jobs and explore entrepreneurship.
Because you're right, it isn't for everybody, because it's really hard and is stressful in a way that, in a different way, I think, to having a sort of proper job, in quotes. But there's something about it that if you love it, then I think once you've, it's hard to go back from, isn't it? You get the bug. But I think you're right in that it's offering that out, trying to get people to see, experience it. So you get different types of people leading businesses is really important.
We definitely want that diversity because, as we all know, that is so much better for society and the economy. And I think also, like I've seen, I set my bits myself. So I've run multiple different businesses, employing people and also solo businesses. Probably my worst one that resulted in, probably helped me get ill, was running a consultancy business on my own, which I just felt really unfulfilling. I was getting paid relatively good money, but I was a consultant. I didn't feel like I was adding value to anyone, even though I was. I didn't ever felt that I got that sort of recognition. So I suppose if you're working in a company, you'll have your team around you and you've got the support from them and you give them support and you get recognition from them and you give them recognition. But when you're working on your own and when you're being paid to be a consultant, it's just expected and it feels like a really thankless task. And often your clients don't have the resources to money or budget or team to do what needs to be done. So yes, that was an example where I definitely wouldn't be encouraging people into entrepreneurship if I was looking at that business that I set up. What I'm doing with Female Founders Rise, which is now paying me a salary, it's taken a while, but I absolutely love it. Obviously, I would definitely be encouraging people if that was a business. And then I think I look at other businesses that I ran, which was employing people, and I had a really nice work-life balance, if you can say that. I do think it was different because when I set my first business at 25, we left our computers at work. It was old school. You went into work every day, you left your computer at work. We had mobiles, but you didn't have anything on your mobile. You didn't have TIN or Instagram or Facebook. All those things hadn't even launched. No, I think LinkedIn launched in 2006, which was the year after we set up our business. People weren't doing that. I didn't even have a BlackBerry. So when I got home, I was just at home with my family, forgetting about work. I think it very much depends on the kind of business that's right for you. And there's so many different types of business, isn't there? And there's so many different ways that you can set it up. And it all depends on the individual, really, like their appetite for risk, whether they're that kind of person that even wants to lead. Yeah. They've all got different advantages and disadvantages.
Yeah, I remember those days I did have a BlackBerry, but me and my friends used to communicate via like email chains. So there was no WhatsApp, there was no sort of constant streams of communication. Yeah. You would send like a group email and then you might write one, I don't know, it's just, yeah.
I think it's very different now. And I think as a founder now, it's very hard to switch off. I do switch off. Well, I try to switch off. I say I do, but I think founders, it's very hard because your business is part of your life. But I think it's harder and harder to switch off now because there's just always something to be done. You can always be on another social platform promoting yourself. You could always be writing more content or videoing more content or going to more networking events. Or we didn't really have networking events and stuff when I was. We had big conferences that we go to, industry conferences. But we didn't have these. You could go to a networking event every day in London if you wanted to. We didn't have any of that.
I guess as well, something to which you just alluded to is personal brand, actually, that there's always more content you can be creating. Yeah. There's putting yourself out on LinkedIn. What do you think are, obviously there's a lot of pros to building a strong personal brand, but do you think that also contributes to that always on feeling?
Yeah, definitely. It's very hard, isn't it? Because I did an accelerator, personal branding accelerator, and the advice is to post every day. And I can see that if you do post every day, it makes a significant difference. And I actually do post most days, and I do it because I actually really enjoy it. I actually really enjoy getting the thoughts and the learnings out of my head and getting them onto paper and writing them in a concise way. And I enjoy reading other people's posts and stuff like that. It's pretty full on. And most founders who are probably running their business don't have time to do that. It's also a cost as well because you need VA support and things like that. So I would say building a personal brand is amazing. There's lots of reports and research that shows the value in that. And we can all see people like Ben from Gymshark who built his personal brand and like how much benefit that's given him. And my perimenopausal brain has forgotten all of their names, but who's the lady that runs Tala?
Grace Beverly.
Yeah, exactly, Grace Beverly. So we can see that building a personal brand really helps. I think it's, and I've seen that, obviously, like I've grown Female Founders Rise to 10,000 members. I don't think we've done any paid ads. It's all come through word of mouth from our members. It's all come through my personal brand, and it's all come from my network and connections and relationships where people have said, I know Emmy and I rate what she's doing and you should go and join. Or people are saying, like, I'm part of Female Founders Rise and you should join. Word of mouth and personal brand has been basically built the whole community. It's also got sponsorships and partnerships with the likes of HSBC, British Business Bank, Shoesmiths, Founder Catalyst, Google. It's probably helped the partnership that we had with London Business School. So I massively see the benefit. It's not just being on LinkedIn. It's personal brand is more than just like your content, isn't it? It's actually what people say about you when you're not in the room. It's about your credibility, your authenticity. It's about everything about you. And therefore, it's going on podcasts. It's speaking at events. It's what you're like at networking events. It's what your comments are on LinkedIn. It's the way that you treat people at events. It's all of those. It's your expertise, your authority. It's so much. But I do think that creating content is definitely helps and is a big part of that.
Yeah. Do you think, I totally get everything you're saying and I've seen the benefit of it too for my own business. Do you ever feel, I feel like there's also quite a lot of pressure with that when everything's linked to you as a person. You know, it's that everything with personal brand, when everything rides on your reputation in a sense.
It's really interesting. I've only built a personal brand since I've been running a community of female founders, and I've been talking about my journey doing that, my journey from recovery, my journey investing in other females and stuff like that. Yeah, I think it is tough. And also, yeah, if you're building a personal brand, where does it stop? Because say, for example, you're running a consultancy a bit like you are, Ruth, and say that you end up hiring more people. In time, everyone only wants to work with you. They want you there. And I see that a bit at FFR. Like, I sometimes find it really overwhelming, like at events and things like that, because everyone knows me, everyone's read my posts, and they want to see me or meet me because I'm the founder of Female Founders Rise. And of course, I love meeting all of them. And it's amazing when it's a small event, like 20 people, I can chat to everyone. It's quite relaxing. But when it's a big event and it's 200 people, I find it really overwhelming.
Yeah, it's a lot of your energy, isn't it, to maintain and then hold that. Yeah.
And I think that it comes with a responsibility as well. Like, I keep noticing I'll get tagged in posts. Like, whenever anyone writes something about someone being awful to a female founder or something about not enough funding to female founders, people tag me and be like, what do you think? As if I'm the oracle in this space, which I'm not. Like, I'm not like an expert at all. It's just something I'm passionate about. And sometimes I feel myself getting like dragged into conversations that I'm like, I'm not an expert. I don't know the answer to this. So I think people they don't put you on a pedestal and they don't put pressure on you, but it's in between those things, as in you are expected to answer on things because you put your hat in the ring and said, I'm passionate about this and I care about it.
So you've got 10,000 members now. It's grown. Well, it's when did you set it up? 2000.
So I set it up 2.5 years ago. I actually set the LinkedIn page up nearly 3 years ago. My first event was with 10 people in December in the snow, and I'd never run an event in my life, and I was absolutely petrified. And that kind of went well, and everyone was like, "When's the next one?" And so then I was like, "Oh, okay, we'll do one in January." And then I think about 30 people came to that, and then in February there was 60, and then in March it was International Women's Day, and there was 130 or something. And then before I knew it, we were hosting an event at Google in May with 170 founders or something.
There's obviously, there was a big gap in the market for this, that people responded so well to it so quickly and in such huge numbers. And now you've got 10,000 members in 2.5 years. And to your point about being seen as like the oracle of female founders, it feels amazing that this didn't exist before, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And this idea has been tapping me on the shoulder for a long time. And I was always too busy doing my consulting and felt, how would I give this? I just never had the opportunity to actually do it. And it's only because I was ill and I had to quit my consultancy and I literally had a blank sheet with nothing that I could bring this idea to life. I don't know if you've read Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert, but basically this book's all about all these ideas floating around the universe and they're waiting to be brought to life, and they keep tapping people on the shoulder and they keep tapping you on the shoulder if you're the right person to bring it to life. And it will only tap you on your shoulder for so long. If you're too busy, you just ignore it and you're continuing on. And I think for so long, I couldn't hear that tapping. And then obviously because I'd been ill, I was like, I'm going to listen to this little tapping on my shoulder and I'm going to do it, because if I don't do it, it's going to find someone else to bring it to life. Of course, there's lots of other people bringing that idea to life, but it meant so much to me that I was like, I'm going to take this idea. I'm meant for it and it's meant for me. And the idea and me have found each other and we know that we're a perfect fit. And it was like that, because everything I've ever learned and everything I've ever done has led me to this place to be the right fit to deliver this support to founders, because I've failed businesses, scaled businesses, sold businesses, raised funding, been on Dragon's Den, had to give angel investment back. So I've understood all of that. I've also worked in marketing and media for 20 years. So I understand A, how to do marketing and media and run a business, but also how to grow a business myself, like the community. I'd also run quite a few communities as well before Female Founders Rise, which hadn't worked. As in they hadn't really grown, but I'd learned a huge amount, which gave me the confidence to be able to like host virtual events, host virtual networking, and to understand like the back end of how it all worked. So when I set it up, it was actually a pretty easy process and none of it scared me. It just all came very naturally and it just grew organically. And as I got better and was able to give more time to it, it just naturally grew.
I love so much about what you just said. I feel like I've been thinking recently that in life, sometimes when you're in the wrong thing, easy things feel hard. And when you're in the right thing, hard things feel easy. And it's like sometimes we talked a bit about entrepreneurship and people getting into it and giving it a go on the side. And that I think if you've done something and it's not worked, so often that is a learning that you're going to apply later and you don't see it yet. It's so rare that something is wasted like that. And I think if you see it all as a learning, and then when it all comes together like it has for you with this, all of the pieces sort of slot into place and you're like, oh, that's why I did that. And that's how I'm using that now. It's a really
interesting, because you'd look back and you'd be like, oh, you tried to set up all these communities and they all failed. None of them went to plan, which they didn't, by the way. Or you'd look back and you'd be like, oh, you set up so many businesses and some have failed and some haven't. And you know, I've done just so many different things and worked in so many different spaces. And then I did some terrible consultancy jobs. But when I look back and I be like, that's why I did that. That's why I worked in that industry, as much as I hated it. It's because I then did X, Y, and Z. So I think what I'm really trying to do with Female Founders Rise is have the growth mindset and just be, everything's a test, everything's a learning, even with my LinkedIn as well, like just always be exploring and be curious. That's my word of the year. Like, how can I be more curious? I remember someone saying that was one of the top traits in leadership, and it got me thinking, God, it really is. If you can just be curious about everything and be like, okay, that flopped. Why did that flop? What can we learn from that? Why was that good? Why was that not good? If you can, I think the more you can have that growth mindset where you're not saying, oh God, I did really badly. I really messed up. That was so bad. I shouldn't have done that. I messed up. I wish I hadn't done that. It's just actually, that was great because I met some amazing people through that. And all your connections that you've ever made, they're all connections and learnings that you're going to take into the next thing, which at some point is going to be the ideal thing.
I feel like growth mindset is the sort of positive flip side of imposter syndrome. That if you can, when you feel like that, which everybody does, especially if you're starting something new and you're building something new, it's, if you can start to see it as, okay, I'm feeling like this because I don't know enough about this. So what can I learn or who can I speak to teach myself, rather than, oh, I don't know this, I'm stupid and I can't do it and I want to give up. I see them as two sides of the same thing. It's just...
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. If someone gives you the opportunity, grab it with both hands. You might make a mistake. You might think you don't know what you're doing, and you probably don't know what you're doing, but you'll learn on the job. And when I set up my first business, I made 60 grand profit in an afternoon. I was 26. I'd never run. We were running a media agency, and I hadn't booked a lot of media. I had experience in the digital space. And one of our clients said, we want to be the lead sponsor for Casino Royale, the film. They were a poker company. And they said, we want to do it in the UK and Europe. And we were their UK agency. And obviously they were just going to ask us because they didn't know anyone else. And I was like, okay, I literally do not have a clue. I've never booked a cinema campaign in my life. But I'd met this guy called Peter a couple of weeks before, who worked for Pearl and Dean. And so I called him up and I was like, Peter, like, I've got this massive potential campaign. Can you help me? And bless him, he took me under his wing. He helped me with the booking and the planning, and I booked a 450 grand campaign, got it signed off and paid by the client in literally no time at all, and we took a 15% margin. So I think in entrepreneurship there's a lot of being like, I literally don't have a clue what I'm doing, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm gonna, you know, we're not brain surgeons, are we? So we're not putting someone's life at risk. We're just gonna say yes. And then we're going to find someone who can help us. We're going to find a way to do it, and we're going to learn on the job, and there will always be people that will help you. And I think the more that you can have that mindset, the better, really. And just, of course, things are going to go wrong, but it's never going to be disastrous, and you'll learn so much. So, yeah, I mean, I look back and I think, God, it probably takes me about 6 months or 8 months to earn that much now, and I earned it in an afternoon, and I was 26, just having the time of my life. I just basically got lovely Peter to do it all for me.
Dreamy. No outgoings either that age. Just spend it all on fun.
Exactly. And also no outgoings on actually booking the cinema campaign, because it was just me brokering a deal.
Yeah, nice. Those are the days. So let's talk a little bit about raising, because I know that's something that you really focus on with Female Funders Rise, and there are a lot of inequalities in the funding landscape. What do you think has changed, and what do you think hasn't?
Tricky question. There's so many stats, and the stats are always changing, like every day. Like the other day, I heard that something like 50% of funding going into founders came from female angels. Wow. I'm constantly, I need to chase that stat up, because there's so many different stats. My understanding was 14% of angel investors in the UK are female. That might have changed, but that was the last big study. 2% approximately of funding is going to all female teams. It's a little bit more to mixed teams, but 80% plus is going to all male teams. And those numbers aren't really changing. So generally the numbers aren't changing. They might go up a bit, they might go down a bit, but in the grand scheme of things, there's not a huge amount of change. The government has just brought out some initiatives like the Invest in Women Task Force. And there's this new thing that literally came out on Friday where there's £500 million that's going into a new emerging fund manager. So this sits above the female founders. It actually goes into the VCs, because the belief is if we give more money to women in venture capital, it will trickle down into more female entrepreneurs. And this does annoy me because it's not a woman's problem to sort out. It's not like,
is that even true?
Why can't the men? No, this. Well, there are stats to show that women are more likely to invest in women. Like, for example, I'm investing in women because I want everything to be, I want there to be equality, and I'm trying to help even level the playing field, as they say. But there are stats that show that women are more likely to invest in women. But then I hate the way that we're like, okay, so let's funnel more money into women investors because they will invest in women. It's, why can't we also get the men? So it's one of those things. Of course, it's great that we're giving female and underrepresented LPs more money in their funds because they're probably more likely to invest it in underrepresented founders. So that's really good. And I love the fact we're doing that. But I'd also like to see the male VCs also looking to invest in more female founders as well, and not putting the pressure always on women to sort out the problem because it's a societal problem.
Oh, completely. And it doesn't feel very long term either, does it? It doesn't feel like that's going to shift anything, create the fundamental shift.
Yeah, we need, the problem is this, like when I first heard this stat, I was absolutely outraged. And that's when I set up Female Founders Rise, actually, it was all at the same time. And I was like, I'm going to sort this out. I was like, there must be a problem that like the investors are not meeting the female founders. So I am going to connect them. And there probably is a bit of that. There are still lots of investors that say there aren't enough female founders to invest in this. Yeah, but are you actually going to any events? Are you actually making any efforts? I think they're not making enough effort, a lot of them. But there are some who are making a brilliant effort. And we see quite a few supporting our community at Female Founders Rise. But there's so many different reasons. There's unconscious bias, there's conscious bias. There's also unconscious bias with female investors as well. So they've seen that female investors can also have unconscious bias against female founders. So there's conscious bias, unconscious bias. There's the fact that, I think we talked about this earlier, female founders are more likely to set up like impact-led businesses or businesses that are answering a problem that they've identified. And often that's not necessarily like a VC-backable business. It's something that's much more impact-led. And there's so many different reasons, but a lot of it is that people are investing in people that they know and trust, which are people that look like them. And if you're saying, if you have domain expertise or you've been to Stanford or you've got X, Y, and Z, you've got these ticks against your name, which take away some of the risk for investors. So they believe, typically, historically, those people have been white men. Mm. So they're more likely to have gone to Stanford, or they're more likely to have succeeded in their space because of the opportunities that, you know, they've had in their life with their networks and everything else. There is a lot to do. I used to get really stressed out about it. Then someone said to me, this is a marathon, not a sprint. Sometimes I'm like, what am I doing? I'm literally bashing my head against a brick wall. People keep asking me what needs to be done. Obviously, we need more funding to go to women. We also need more funding types because most founders aren't building VC backable businesses. So we need funding types that suit founders of all kinds of businesses. And as I said, like many female founders are building more impact-led businesses and need different funding. So it's that. I think there's lots of other things as well. Like historically, men have had very strong networks and women less. Obviously, that's changing with things like Female Founders Rise and other communities. And we're trying to like open that up. But historically, things like networks have been much more prevalent with men. We also know that women are much more conservative. For example, I'm always hearing VCs say women need to double their figures and with men, you should probably just halve what they say. But the problem is a guy will go in and say, I'm building $1 billion company. And actually, realistically, it's going to be half of that if he's lucky and he literally hits all his targets. And a woman will go in and she'll say, be so conservative because we want, that's how we've been brought up. And actually say way less than probably what we would achieve. So yeah, I think it's, I remember when I sold my business, I was very humble about the money I'd made. I didn't want to tell anyone. I didn't tell anyone because I was just taught to believe that we shouldn't talk about money and kind of rude. But then I don't think that's the way that men, of course, these are sweeping generalizations. Yeah, it's just the way that we've been brought up in society. So a lot of that needs to change. And also we need to be hearing way more women. And that's another thing we're trying to do. Like 80% of young children can't name a female founder, but they all know about Jeff Bezos and all those other. And we need to celebrate the women that are doing amazing stuff. And we need to hero them. And we need to get the voices of more women in media. And when you look at all the LinkedIn top creators, they're all male. So we're hearing the stories of men, and we need to hear the more stories of women.
Yeah.
Women entrepreneurs.
Do you also think you're an angel investor? I've just started. We've made two, looking to make another. Yeah, really cool. And part of the reason for that, firstly, because I feel like we've been in the industry long enough that we need to start putting our money where our mouth is. And if we really believe in something, then that's the way to prove it. But secondly, I think as women, it's important, and it's important to talk about it and in the same way you demystify entrepreneurship, demystifying investing money as well, to your point. I think it's a good thing for more women to get into. They don't have to only invest in other women. You invest where you want to.
Exactly. You can invest in where you've got expertise, where you've got passion. And I agree with that. And one of the things that I do every Friday with Pause for the Summer, and we're also setting up for the podcast, is the Alternative Funding Show. And that's all about non-VC funding. So mainly angel investment, getting angel investment. And we're interviewing lots of angel investors. And most of those, many of those are women. And we've got Jenny Tooth, who set up the UK British Angel Association in the UK. We've also got people who are like running angel collectives, like Alma Angels, like Roxanne came on. So we're really just trying to get the message out there that you don't need to be like a millionaire to be an angel investor. I've done a lot of angel investments of £1,000. And there's lots of people out there who've got small amounts of disposable money, who it's also tax efficient, who don't actually know about this. You've got like highly intelligent people who've got disposable cash, women. And because we're not talking about it, it's a bit of a hidden, not secret, but I do think that it is a bit of a, what's the word? It's almost like, it's hard to get into it if you don't know what you're doing. And there's a lot of angel collectors that keep it a bit guarded. Can't get in unless you're an exit operator who's made loads of money. So therefore, you're probably going to be a white man. They're not all like that. There's some amazing ones. So you've got Sea Ventures, you've got Alma Angels, you've got Angel Academy. There's actually some really brilliant, Essa. There's some really brilliant collectives which invest in female founders, and therefore there's quite a few female angels in there, and they will have different rules about like what you need to invest and how much, what your available funds needs to be and stuff like that. But we need to talk about it more, because it's an amazing thing to do, and if you've got a little bit of disposable money, it is risky, obviously. Like I've had quite a few of my investments go under already, but then I've also got some that are absolutely flying.
Yeah, I think you have to. But all these are all things that you can learn, right? About building out a balanced portfolio and adjusting your risk. And I think maybe to the other point about if women are statistically more likely to be conservative, that's going to affect the way they invest as well, right? If we're
Yes, apparently, exactly. Women will take much, much longer. I read somewhere that I think they're actually, their angel investments are more, that they have like more lucrative investments. There's so many stats flying around all the time, but essentially someone was saying in their network or their collective, they noticed that women take a huge amount longer to do their first angel investment, whereas the guys are just ready to go, raring to go, put the money in and they're off. And women are much more considered about it. And yeah, that's just obviously the way that we've been brought up, maybe society, I don't know. We're talking big, sweeping generalizations here. Like I would say I'm more risk loving than my husband. My husband's very risk averse when it comes to money, and I'm like, but maybe that's the entrepreneur in me.
So you mentioned right at the beginning you got four kids and you've built multiple businesses. Obviously this is like a whole subject for a podcast on its own, but there are some unique challenges of building a business and balancing motherhood. I guess actually I think this is very covered ground, but what I would like to ask is, what do you think has made you better at business from being a mother?
Talking about this to someone the other day, I think being a mum makes you a phenomenal entrepreneur, because you have insane amounts of empathy and understanding, which is really important. You probably very resilient. It's pretty hard work, isn't it? Having kids and running a business. I think it also makes you really determined and passionate. Like for me, if I'm going to do this, it's because I really want to do it and I really believe in it. And otherwise, I'd just go and work for someone else. So I'd say there's lots of things. I think there's so many learnings that we get from both sides, actually. And I think, obviously, being able to juggle multiple things at once, holding many different thoughts and ideas and things that need to be done in your head and executing on them all and making sure that generally they all go to plan is... And I think it's also mastering, I think, the empathy thing and the understanding and managing relationships is so important. And I honestly think if you can be a mum and a founder, you've got so much going for you. I really take my hat off to everyone who does it, and it's very hard. It is hard work, and there's a lot of invisible work that we do as well as mums that isn't necessarily noticed or recognised. And actually, it's really interesting. Debbie and I were talking about this because we're doing a big piece of research. There's a lot of stuff about, oh, women could add more to the economy and da-da-da-da, which of course they could, but women are already adding a huge amount to the economy, but it's just not recognised.
One thing I saw that you shared or that you've told me, which I absolutely loved, is you had some like of your tips of how you balance the two, and you don't do any class WhatsApps.
No, I don't do any. I don't do any class WhatsApps. I also don't do any one-to-one work calls with anyone unless it's a sponsor or someone, a member of my team. For example, I've got 10,000 members, so I just have to have an agreement that's fair for everyone. I do very few Zoom calls. And one of the things that I was saying that I love doing is getting the train. And my husband's brilliant because he doesn't mind doing this, but I get the train and I'll sometimes take a couple of the kids, but then I put them in a different carriage or I put them on a different table. I'll go and sit at the other end of the carriage. And then I just am on my own for 2 hours. And that is another thing that makes a massive difference. There's just lots of small things that I do because obviously I've been ill and I know how important it is to manage everything. So yeah, I think obviously I have lots of help in the house and help with childcare. And I think we should all talk about that, because if you don't have that and you don't have either your family to help you or you don't have a nanny or childcare, it is very difficult, or you've got support through schools. But yeah, I think it's hard, but I love it. And I think if you're passionate about what you're doing, then it's okay. It makes it easier.
I think what you've just alluded to there as well is, I think you get really ruthless with your time and like energy and prioritization. So you're just like, no group chats, because the toll on my energy levels is too high. And then
Exactly. You're so right. It's all about conserving energy. And it's basically, I know I need to do my exercise or my movement every day. Like sometimes I see people and they're like going, yeah, I'm going to the gym. I go twice a week, or I do one class. And I'm like, I literally do something every day, because if I don't, I don't feel good. So like, I totally prioritize that. I will not go to, I won't, for example, speak at events in the evening or anything like that. There's so much that I won't do and that I say no to. And obviously I say yes to a lot of things as well, but I'm only saying yes to things that are moving me forward in the focus of what I need at FFR, or that are of benefit to my family or my well-being and like my friends and stuff. I used to just do a lot of stuff that people wanted me to do that wasn't actually, and it's not a selfish thing like saying helping me or supporting me. I do lots to help and support people, but there was a lot that I was doing before that, a lot of people picking my brains, a lot of that kind of thing, which actually I don't do any of that anymore. So yeah, getting ruthless with my energy and being mega focused on where I can create the most impact and where I can prioritize my own well-being.
Yeah, it's not selfish at all. And I think that's another thing that probably is a more female trait of that sort of people-pleasing tendency to say yes to too many things and spread yourself too thin. And actually, when you start to say no, people really respect that as well.
Yeah.
Healthy boundaries.
I know. There's always quite often, I think at the last event, I had about three people coming up to me saying, oh, I need to pick your brains. I need to arrange a call with you. And I said, oh, that's lovely, but I won't be able to do it. I don't do one-to-ones. And you can see their face. They're quite shocked. And I can't do one-to-ones because we've got 10,000 people in the community. So I think to some people, they find it quite shocking. But I always remember my friend saying, I just heard you say that and I'm so proud of you. Well done. But just saying no, because actually we should all be protecting our energy.
I think that person is shocked, and then they go away and think about it, and then they're like, hang on, that's great.
Well, exactly. They might be shocked at the time, but hopefully they will go away, and it will give them, it will, and it's like I cancelled speaking at London Tech Week because I was ill, and it was such a difficult decision because I'd wanted to speak at London Tech Week for being on my sort of goal, dream, vision board for a couple of years. But so many people were like, thank you so much for doing that because it's given us, given me the knowledge that I can do the same.
What do you know now you wish you'd known at the beginning of this journey?
I think we're always learning. We've got the growth mindset. So it's not about having regrets or wishing you knew something or anything like that. But what I would say I've learned is I've learned a huge amount. I have learned that it is, I think one of the biggest things about community is it's incredibly demanding and incredibly rewarding, and it's very hard to make it work financially, which is why most communities do not last. There's a lot of work involved and a lot of love, and then when you can't pay yourself, it feels for many people, and I can understand why, it's just feels upsetting and not great. So I think that's something that I've realized and learned, and people did tell me that from the beginning, but trying to find a way to monetize a community is very hard, and I'm still working on it, but I'm getting there. I think the main thing is I've just been overwhelmed by the impact of the community on the members, and the impact of the community on me, and the impact of the community on each other. It's been a huge part of me getting better, and I'm incredibly grateful that I get to do this every day of my life and hopefully for the rest of my life, and it brings me such joy. I feel very lucky. And then on the other side, I see the huge impact it's making on our members. I get a message every single day from someone saying, I got funded, or I've met a new co-founder through you, or I've got a new client through you, or I've met my new best friend, or I got featured on a podcast, or I've built my personal brand, or like every day I'll get a message from someone or a comment on one of my posts that will tell me that it's had a meaningful impact on them. So yeah, it's all learnings. I could talk to you about so many learnings, but having the growth mindset and being open to the learnings has been the best thing.
Amazing. Final question, and we ask everyone this. What, in your opinion, makes a brand of tomorrow?
Oh, in my opinion, makes a brand of tomorrow. I would say keeping your customers at the heart of everything you do. And basically, if you always put your customers first, if you're always speaking to them, if you're always finding out what's needed, and if you're always helping them create something better in their lives, you are going to be a success. So for me, putting the customer at the core of everything, being generous, being collaborative, and yeah, that's what comes into my head.
Love it. Thank you so much for coming on.